many people read the McLean's magazine? Anybody read that? Okay. If you get a chance to get a hold of a copy, I would really strongly encourage you to read the story of 10 Aboriginal women and their journey. And I really was very deeply moved by it. And they were tracing back because there's a lot of women that have disappeared over time. And some part of it's nomadic, but it's not totally all of that reason. It's kind of been sad to point out, although it's maybe not so prevalent here, but definitely out west. They have been seen as the scourge of the people groups. And anyway, what I was very interested in is that they're beginning to take back, frankly, what the enemy stole from them. And they're tracing back even to their grandmothers, their mothers. I didn't realize there was what they called a 60s scoop, where they took the children out from the home. And part of it was because the parents of those children had been raised in residential schools, and they had so many problems. A lot of abuses and that sort of thing. Just the trauma of taking a child from their home and never seeing their family again is going to create some issues. But then in the 60s, they took those children away as well. And so what they've traced is the pattern that these people lost everything. And my heart was just grieving because I thought, God, I never really understood what's going on. But there seems to be a generation now that's saying, no more. We are going to make a difference. And some of these women have literally, some have gone back to the roots, some have embraced the church, but they said there has to be something bigger than this, and they're making a difference for their own children, that they are going to do something in life besides be a victim. And so I would encourage you to read it, because I said to Brian, I know he's working with a counselor who has to deal with a lot of Native community issues and that. But I said, you need to read this and encourage your friend, the counselor, to read this, because I said it helps understand the level of pain that those people are in. Not totally, but there's people who have come out and said things. They said, I've never told anybody any of this. But if it's going to make a difference for people to understand and for other women who feel they were basically told this is what a Native expects, to be abused sexually, physically, this is just part of your life. And I just thought, man, non-Christians do not understand the freedom in Christ. That he says, you don't have to take this because I already paid the price. And you can be set free. And so just continue to pray. I know a number of years ago that God laid it on our hearts for Native people, and we began to intercede. And it was interesting, even in the prayer meetings at night and that there was actually, it was almost like a war dance for them. And we found out later there were some very significant things begin to shift in the Native communities, including the government apologizing to them for some of the things that happened to them. So that's just sort of a sideline thing, but I really felt that I would hate for you to miss reading when you have the chance to see a deeper level than you will at the surface that we all know. So anyway, question for you. How many have learned at some point in your life how to ride a bike? Okay. Well, I'm glad. That's everybody. You too, Cynthia, right? Yes, good, good. So everybody can understand what I'm about to say. How many are still riding one today? Oh, awesome. How many would hate to admit just how long it's been since you've been on a bike? Okay. But, you know, it's what they say is true. No matter how long since you've ridden one, once you've learned, you never truly forget. I know Leah purchased a bike not long ago. She says, Pam, you got to take it for a spin. And I'm thinking, it's been so long. And yet when I hopped on the bike, I could do it. But really, the key to riding a bike is balance. Once you learn how to balance, you don't forget it. You learn that if you lean too much one way, you'll fall over. And if you lean too much the other way, you'll fall over. Trick question, yes. Matter of fact, I still remember the day when I discovered I could ride without holding on to handlebars. And I learned it riding downhill. Now I'm thinking, my goodness. Because once I learned to balance, it wasn't how I held things or whatever else. It was balance. That's why people can ride a unicycle. You know, it's really hard to describe a father's role in modern times. And the reason for that is that our culture has made such a dramatic shift. It used to be that, you know, the man went out to work, the woman stayed home. There was more defining roles. And it, if anything, you know, some people have painted a grim picture. It wasn't all grim for a lot of people. They felt comfortable with that role. And if anything, some people have tried as much as they can to go back to the role. If one person can do a greater income than the other one can be a somewhat of a stay-at-home parent. But because of that, that both parents pretty well have to work outside the home now, and that's not a luxury thing. It's just that's how it works because of the finances in the home. So there was a dramatic shift. And so when you start to wrestle with what is the defining definition of a father's role, it is very difficult. But one of the words that I would say that's key for a father is balance. That is not an easy thing to accomplish. And frankly, I'm sure Adam, you're in this stage too. Bob, you're in this stage. You second guess. Am I doing this right? Am I not doing it right? I remember even when we sent Dan off to university, there was that feeling, did everything we could? You're always going to second guess yourself. But there is that sense of how to bring balance into the role. Every person in this room has a different picture angle of what a father is supposed to be like. I think if we surveyed people, every one of us would have different answers. And a main part of that is because the influence of our picture came from our own homes. Whether good or bad, when you say father, you immediately that's the first picture is the one that you have. My father's parenting style definitely leaned towards being an authoritarian. You know what that's for some of you. What he said, you know, what he said goes. And it was just one level below, yes, sir, right away, sir. Now, people hearing that would say, that's terrible. But they don't understand, because they weren't in my home, that that was not the whole picture of my dad. That was a portion of my dad. You have to be able to embrace the whole picture to understand how the home worked. Yes, as children, my siblings and I got a healthy level of respect, if you want to say good fear, for my dad's authority in the home. If we got into trouble, let's say at school, etc., it wasn't mom we were worried about. It was dad. And I can tell you this, I was the nauseating perfect child, the goody two-shoe one, and I found out later on years that some of my siblings didn't appreciate that role because it made them look worse. Because really, none of them were that bad, but my brother, he definitely was a guy. And he liked to try stuff out. And so he made me look better all the time. But I remember this one particular time we were, people would maybe understand. My dad and mom, my dad was the school principal, my mom was the teacher. And as soon as school was out for the summer, my dad would pack up everything and he would become an evangelist on the road with the tent services and everything else. And there could be up to 3 services every day. So, I mean, I had church enough for a lifetime by the time I was 12. But that gets kind of boring after a way for kids. I mean, you do it, right? You know, and it's not, listen, I have no regrets because it formed me who I am today, and a very strong foundation. But at times, he got a little bored, and my brother got maybe a little more than bored one day when he decided it would be kind of fun if he pulled the electrical cord on the camp meeting service. And so the lights went out, the PA system went out, everything else. And he thought that was kind of funny, he and his friend. But see, Scott wasn't actually that smart because he thought he'd try it again. But what he didn't realize that my dad was watching for whoever did it this time. So guess what? My dad caught him. And it gave him a whole new meaning to the verse of the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. I would say the word fear, unfortunately for most of us, we have a connotation of it, modern language, whatever, that we think of fear almost like you're cowering in a corner waiting to be beaten. You know, terror, I guess, would be a better word when we think fear. And so if you want to change it, and hopefully it's strong enough connotation, but the word respect. You're not cowering in fear, but if you change that, and it may help you, the respect of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. I meet people, and if I know that they have an awesome respect for God, they're already on a good road because it's the beginning of wisdom. That's part of the problem. I said to Brian, we were talking this morning, I said there's such a lack of respect for God, even to say that he doesn't exist anymore, that you see people, it seems like they're just getting more stupid all the time. Well, it's the beginning of wisdom to have respect for him. That's the starting point. So, but I want to get back to this thing of discipline, that it was not the only, it was only one aspect of my father's role in life. It was not its entirety. There was much more to my dad than being the disciplinarian, the authority structure, whatever. My dad has, because he has not left this earth yet. Oh, I did want to make something very clear, though, because I don't know if you realize, but they're going to try to bring before the Supreme Courts again about spanking. And we know that it's probably just a matter of time before that one becomes totally illegal. It's not illegal yet, but they are definitely pushing towards that. But, and you know what? There's lots of different forms besides that. So it's a wise thing to kind of, you know, stay so that you have a safety zone for your child as much as possible. Discipline can come in a lot of forms, but the Bible's very clear, a child who's never disciplined has a sad future waiting for him. It's absolutely imperative that a father has the ability to discipline their child, some form. And so, but anyway, as I said, that was not the whole of my dad. He had a keen sense of humor and fun that he passed on to all of us. Obviously, he didn't think my brother's form of fun was that funny. But, you know, the reality is my dad definitely, and now he'll talk about it and kind of laugh, but at the time it wasn't that funny. But my dad was also a provider. He was a protector. Heaven help anybody that touched his little kid. He is still an advisor, and he's a friend. I knew if I was in trouble, he'd be there for me. The world felt safe when my dad was around. He wasn't perfect. He's not perfect. But then who but God is? God, the only perfect father. Yet many people are so out of balance of what that means. And as I said before, it's a lot to do with their earthly father's picture. It's especially hard for people who had either an abusive father or a non-existent one. Very, very hard to overcome that. But I can tell you, having met people who have really got to know God well, they have been able to overcome that image. Many still see him as how the children of Israel saw him in Exodus chapter 19. If you want to turn there, if those that are inclined to do it. In Exodus chapter 19. And the story that surrounds Exodus chapter 19, the children of Israel are at Mount Sinai, and this is where the Ten Commandments are given out. And so God's presence is showing up, and there's thunder and lightning and the mountains shaking, and they're told not to touch the mountain because if they touch the mountain, they will die. And so Exodus 19, the latter part of verse 13, it says, only when the ram's horn sounds a long blast may they approach the mountain. So all this is happening. God says they cannot approach this until they hear the ram's horn. So when you hear this description, and if you want to picture it, it's like a volcano. Not too many of us are that gutsy to get near a volcano that is erupting. A lot of people who want to dismiss this as being, you know, Moses' sort of freak show to keep the people in line, they say it was a volcano, which Mount Sinai has never shown any volcanic activity. But here's the reason why it wasn't a volcano, too. It says their response, and this is in Exodus chapter 20 now, Exodus 20, verse 18 to 21, says, when the people saw the thunder and lightning and heard the trumpet, okay? You do not hear trumpets if the volcano is going off. So this kind of validates that it wasn't a volcano. And saw the mountain in smoke, they trembled with fear. They stayed at a distance and said to Moses, speak to us yourself and we will listen, but do not have God speak to us or we will die. Now, these people are not cowards. They've done, you read and you think, oh my goodness, that's so cowardice. I guarantee every person here, if you saw that event, you'd be scared. You'd be petrified. Why did God bother doing this display? Because our humanity, there's terror in this at this point. This is what Moses said to the people in verse 20. Do not be afraid. God has come to test you so that the fear, and I put in brackets, respect of God will be with you to keep you from sinning. It says you need to know, to a certain extent, the guy you're messing with here. He's not your best bud here. He's a holy God. He's all-powerful, all-knowing, ever-present. And we have to know that. When I read that, it reminded me the respect for my earthly father helped keep me out of trouble. We were talking this morning, Brian and I were discussing the thing of an electric fence. I don't know, those invisible fences that dogs have, right? They get a little collar. First little few times that he goes to go towards the fence, it's going to be a zap, right? Now, this is going to be a little pain here. Sooner or later, the dog figures out you don't go in that zone. So you could take the collar off and he's never going to stop. My father, there were certain parameters that you learned, maybe with a little bit of pain, not to cross those parameters. And after that, you were safely within the zone of being okay. I was going to grow up to an adult, healthy, happy, safe. And what God was doing here, he was trying to set parameters on these people. He said, so to stop you from sinning. If you know the power I have, the respect that is needed, frankly, to save you from yourselves. I was thinking about that the other day. We were talking about it, Brian and I, the other day. A sin, when it's finished, brings forth death. It always seems like, oh, that's not too bad. That's not too bad, right? But you go down that path far enough with that person's choosing, you wouldn't wish that on your worst enemy. We have to see sin like that first cancer cell that's going to eat a person alive. God's saying, the respect you need to have to keep you from sinning. What did the people do in response to that? They said, the people remained at a distance while Moses approached. approached the thick darkness where God was. They said, "Sorry, Moses, this is too much for us. We're going to stay far away from him." And basically from the Old Testament through, that's what they did. They had arm's length of God. It didn't stop them from disrespecting him in the sins that they've committed, because you can read it later on in the Old Testament. It was pretty horrendous stuff. But they never wanted a close relationship, because all they saw was God was the fear of respect. As I said, it's one aspect of God, that side, and you can't ignore it. But out of balance, you'll ditch your bike. If that's all you see him, if that's all I ever saw my dad was the disciplinarian, then I'm going to have a rotten childhood. When Jesus came to earth, he put a human face on God. Turn to John chapter 14 if you want. John chapter 14, I'm going to read verse 8 to 11. This was the time when the disciples were wanting some information from Jesus. So John 14 says, "When his disciple Philip asked him, 'Lord, show us the Father, and that will be enough for us.' And what does Jesus respond? He says, 'Don't you know me, Philip? Even after I have been among you such a long time, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Don't you believe that I am in the Father and that the Father's in me? The words I say to you, I don't speak on my own authority. Rather, it is the Father living in me who is doing his work. Believe me when I say that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or at least believe on the evidence of the works themselves." So my question is, what were some of the things Jesus did as evidence of the Father doing the work? In Luke 4, verse 18, Jesus announced and produced what he said when he said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised." That says he cares. He's not out to beat them. He says, "I love them. I want to heal them." Jesus defended the woman caught in adultery. Wasn't the fact that the sin wasn't sin and everything else. He didn't like the attitude of those people. He said, "No way." And then he turned to her and he says, "I don't condemn you either, but stop sinning." He didn't say to just carry on. Matthew 19:14, it says, Jesus said, "Let the children alone and do not hinder them from coming to me, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these." You ever met a man who sits down and all the little kids just kind of run towards him? He's got this personality. Kids just feel safe. I remember Brian, Ed, I don't know if he's got it so much before, but all the little girls used to make eyes with him. And you'd watch them lean way back at the table if they could catch his eye, and he'd make faces at them. They felt safe. He was telling me one day, my sister's younger daughter, Brian was just sitting on the couch, and he says, "Pam, out of the blue, she just walked over and crawled up and put her head right down by my neck and went to sleep." He says, "I don't know." I said, "Oh, it's that magnetic personality." But there was a sense of feeling safe. And when Jesus said, "Don't stop these children coming to me," there was that same pull for them, the Father's heart bringing them. They felt loved. Some of the people caught on that they had a Father who loved them. In the New Testament, you read, some of them really caught on, others didn't. But it says he loved them whatever state they were in. I mean, the woman caught in adultery would be able to say that quite easily. He loved her, and it didn't matter what state, didn't matter what mess, in all her mess, in all of our messes, to be able to, he was there for them. We even look from the beginning of Adam and Eve. What happened when they sinned? They hid themselves. Because they're going, oh my goodness, we're naked. And so when God came calling for them, even back then you're seeing the compassion of a father. They said, we can't come because we're naked. And what does he do? He made clothes for them to cover them up. That's what love does. Love covers a multitude of sins. Doesn't mean the sin doesn't have to be dealt with, but he wasn't going to bring shame upon them. I like what, I was going to say the overbalance of that, though, because I don't know, maybe people have heard this for years, God, the Father's heart and God's love. And that's all they talk about is God's love. And I don't know if you've heard this before, but Brian and I have certainly been challenged by different people. And different churches, unfortunately, are totally embracing this doctrine. It says, if God is the love, then no loving God could do something like the flood. Because they got the one aspect of picture of God. And he's absolute love. You fill in the blank what you want. If God is love, then no loving God would do this, whatever it is. Yes. Your bike's about to tip in the other direction if you embrace it too much. I like what Eugene Peterson, who wrote about God in the Message Bible, he said, God's kind, but he's not soft. I don't know, I don't have a memory for a lot of things, but I tried to keep that one, and I like that. God's soft, or God's kind, but he's not soft. Very good description there. A lot of people say, oh, that's the Old Testament God, this is the New Testament God. I just want to show a little bit of weaving here. New Testament, God takes a very dim view of a man who will not provide for his family. That's in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 8, if anybody wants to look that up. King David, who probably saw God more balanced than most people, Old Testament writes this. He was a man after God's own heart. God told him that. He says, David actually knows the heart of God here. And this is what he says in Psalm 68, verse 5. It says, a father, this is talking about God, he says, a father of the fatherless and a judge of the widows is God in his holy habitation. You see the two things combined, God in his holy habitation, but he's a father to the fatherless. The kindness and the holiness at the same time. Old Testament again, King Solomon, the wisest man to ever live, wrote in Proverbs 23, verse 10 and 11, he says, do not move an ancient boundary stone. Basically, it's like don't change the line of a property. It's talking about, people can use it for other things, but it's don't cheat the person beside you here. It says, don't move the ancient boundary stone, but or encroach on the fields of the fatherless, or the orphans here. It says, for their defender, capital D, which I put in brackets afterwards, God, is strong. He will take up their case against you. Solomon says, God will defend those that do not have a father. You remember, I don't know if you ever did this, I certainly remember this, playgrounds, you know, little kids who said, well, my dad can beat up your dad. Anybody ever did that? I don't know if they still do that, but I remember that. And, you know, then it got, well, my brother can beat your brother up. But I mean, the reality is, those kids' dad really can beat you up. So you really don't want to pick a fight with him. And he says, don't mess with my children. Because he says, you'll have to deal with me. And as I said, I'm just trying to give a balanced picture as God is Father, both Old Testament and New Testament. I want to give a final family photo this morning to finish Father's Day for you. Because it's really hard to describe God and all the different angles in that. So I can only give you some somewhat of experience to give that picture for you. Many of you know a few years ago that our oldest son Dan went to Newfoundland to university. And God definitely called Dan out there. He brought Leah back for us. But at the time, we didn't know. Obviously, looking back, we can see, but the future, it was very, God, we don't understand any of this. And I have to say that it was very, very hard on all of us. It was the first time our family unit had ever been divided for such a long period of time. And so Thanksgiving time came, and due to finances and lack of time, Dan was going to have to stay in Newfoundland. And he was homesick. He was desperate to be home. And I can tell you what a helpless feeling it is as a parent that we could not comfort him in any way. We knew he had to go through this journey alone. If I could have, I would have hopped on a plane just to be with him. But we knew that it was part of the growing up experience for all of us. The only bright spot for Dan was that he found out that the Newsboys, which is a music group, and that was actually the group that was Dan's role model. It probably was the most single factor of the main reasons why Dan ever even pursued a career in music. But he found out that this group was going to perform a concert in the area. Unbeknownst to me, though, Dan was excited about that, even though he was mourning the fact that he couldn't be home. But unbeknownst to me, Brian, because he was hurting for Dan so much, he was trying to figure out a way to contact the group to see if they would say hi to Dan from the stage. I know he looks conservative, but there's a part of Brian that he's a risk taker. And so Dan was going to go to a concert of 3,000 people. And Brian was hoping somehow that he could convince these guys to say hi to Dan from the stage. I was just like, okay. Brian was not able to make contact with the group, and frankly, the request probably would have been denied anyway because it would have set a precedence for others to ask as well. And, I mean, they only have so much concert time, and you can't say hi to 3,000 people by name. So, but I remember early that Sunday morning of Thanksgiving weekend, we got a call from Dan. And I actually, it was recorded, so I still have a recording someday that it could be, I'd have to dig it out, but it was like, Mom, Dad, guess what? You'll never believe what happened. And I mean, you know, for us, when we heard the message, we panicked thinking, why would he call us so early in the morning? It was about 3-4 o'clock in the morning sort of thing. And so but the excitement in the voice, you knew it wasn't a bad call, you just didn't know what. And he says, you will not believe what happened. He says, I was at the concert. And he said, and at the end of the concert, the drummer came over to me and he says, you are such an inspiration to me. I want you to have my drumsticks. And he says, more than that, he says, why don't you come back and meet the band and the stage dance? Really? He says, yeah, he says, you can sign them all. So Dan got the drumsticks, and he went back and he met the whole band. It was like Dan was in absolute awe of what happened. If you have any, you know, movie stars or rock stars to be invited backstage past the only person to get this and have this happen. And so, of course, Dan's over the moon. And well, Brian and I heard this, we both teared up because we knew how much this meant to him. And then God spoke to Brian. And he says, although they did not hear your request, he said, I did. And he says, I want you to know I'm a better father than you will ever be. Not that you don't love your kid. He says, I am a better father than you will ever be. And he says, I can comfort him when you can't. He says, trust me with your son and see what I will do. It underlined again how much God cared. Because you got to have the balance. He is a holy, he is to be respected. But he loves you like Brian was willing to go to bat for his son. For something so stupid as being able to say hi to your idol, so to speak. In a godly sense, idol. When I thought of that, I couldn't help but read Matthew 7, verses 9 to 11. And I think it's one of those ones that you at times need to be able to embrace. Matthew 7, verses 9 to 11. This is what Jesus asked. He says, "Which of you, if your son asks for bread, will he give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? If you then, though you are evil," now we're talking about evil as you are an imperfect father here. He says, "though you are imperfect, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him?" And sometimes we don't even know we're asking him. I guess this morning what I wanted to say, it really doesn't matter what your earthly father was like. And you can stay back there in the pain and miss out on the important now. Because you have a heavenly father who loves, cares, and looks out for you like there's no tomorrow. And that really should make a happy Father's Day for all of us.
Well, I don't think there's anything I can add to that, or should. Let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you that you do love us and care for us and watch over us, watch over our families, our children. You're there when we can't be there. You're there when we are there. And we ask that you would continue to help us to learn of you, that we would both respect and receive love from you. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.